You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolensky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats.
Around.
Wow. Today is a potluck where we answer your questions. We've got questions about how big is too big for state and memory. How much do I need to know to apply to a dev job? Skeletons. I'm a big fan of this new trend of skeleton wireframes while things are loading. CSS reach sets. All kinds of cool stuff coming right at you. Today, we are sponsored by Sentry and Sanity. Sentry is going to do all of your error and exception tracking. And Sanity is going to be your headless CMS. They got some new stuff that's called Sanity Create. We're going to talk about partway through this episode. With me today is Scott Tolensky. How are you doing today, Scott?
Doing really good. Well, it's beautiful out here, and I'm taking so much time to make our backyard feel cozier, right? I feel like in Denver here, the sun is pretty intense when it's out, which is, 300 plus days a year. So we get a lot of sun in my backyard in particular, especially in the first half of the day, is just full sun. And it's really difficult to really just hang out back there because it can get really hot. So we've been trying to do a couple of things and we're wanting to make our backyard much more cozy. So I planted some aspen trees. I got a giant 10-foot offset umbrella. We're gussing it up a bit. Gussing it up? Is that a thing?
Gussying.
Yeah. Either way, we've been trying to make our backyard so much more cozy and it's just been so much fun. I know we talk about working away from the computer, but to be honest, I spent my entire weekend working, shoveling and doing all that stuff in the backyard. And it feels awesome. It felt awesome to not even look at screens for that long. And that's really a challenge for me. So I'm feeling nice and refreshed coming in this week, ready to get this potluck going.
Awesome. Yeah, we spent the weekend just outside as well. I got a new table for my barbecue. I have a big green egg smoker.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
And I had bought it last in the fall, and it was just too cold to ever put it in, and it's super heavy, so you got to get someone to help you. And we got that all set up, and I bought a piece of granite for the top, and you can go to the Restore. You have the Restore down there? It's like Habitat for Humanity. It's where people donate building products that are still good. So we bought a piece of granite and just cut into the table and slabbed it in. It looks awesome.
Nice. Yeah, Restore is the one with the refresh icon as their logo, right?
Restore. Let me see. Not in Canada. It's just the Habitat for Humanity logo.
Oh, well, it's like a house with two arrows circling around it, like the refresh. Oh,
yeah. I think that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Cool. So let's get into some of these questions here. This is the potluck where every single person brought some really, really tasty questions. I'm looking at how long some of these questions are. They're like paragraphs in here. So these are going to be some funny questions, and funny by I mean funny long questions. This first one is from Johnny Three Hats. I don't believe that's your name. I am not easily fooled. I am easily fooled, and we have been fooled often. Johnny Three Hats, if that's your name, then please tweet at me. So many people, they try to get one by us. So I don't know. I don't know if this one's getting by me, but if you are real, I reserve that. Hey, Wes and Scott, how big is too big for state? I have an object of around 1,000 items, which will be used in a search box on the front end of my site, but the list of items won't be updated very often. What is the most efficient way to store these items and deliver them to your browser? Would you use state, a JSON object, MongoDB document, and some other way that I haven't thought of? This is for a side project. While maximum efficiency isn't vital, I'm also keen to learn real-world best practices. Thanks so much for the laughs. Heart emoji. Thank you, Johnny Three Hats. Wes, what do you think about this one? How much is too much?
I think 1,000 items. It depends on what's in each item, but
yes,
it's likely just an object with a description and a title and maybe an image and like your standard everyday table object that you might run across. I don't think 1,000 is too much to hold in memory. I think the thing that you need to know about having things in your JavaScript is, first, does it increase the load time of your JavaScript bundle? Chances are 1,000 items in an array is probably going to significantly increase your JavaScript. So I would probably load that in on demand once the page has actually loaded itself. You can fire off a request to do that. then I think when someone starts typing, there's a question of, should it be in memory already? Again, is lazy loading that going to be big? I think if it's anything over, I don't know, like 40, 50K maybe or something like that, you probably should build some sort of backend that will just return the results to you. If it's much smaller than that, I would just keep them all in memory. There is like a memory tab in Chrome that you can take a snapshot. And I don't really know how to use this all that much. But if there were a problem, you would see that the size of it would be like the snapshot is specifically larger than other websites. And then, you know, you sort of have a problem. Other questions, would you use state? If it's just an object, then yeah, you can put it into state. A JSON object, MongoDB document, or some other way I haven't heard of. Again, it really depends on how big it is. If it's just a title, a description, and an image, I probably would load all 1,000 in at once and then just hold them in memory from there. What would you think to do?
This is one of those ones I've never done. I would need to test. I think that's the only solid way to do it is to test it, push it to the limit, and see where those limits end up being. But to be honest, I really don't know. I don't know the answer. I think it's one of those things that you might only be able to figure out through trying something, trying a different technique, record your performance and seeing what works best, or reach out to somebody who that's their specialty. There are people who work in large amounts of data, maybe even if it's with graphing or whatever, and reach out to those people that's their specialty and see, hey, what's your preferred way of storing all of this data here?
What other people will also do is they'll just stick it in the HTML of the document as that page loads.
Yes.
And then you can just like put it as like window dot underscore underscore results. And then you can just grab that for the global variable and stick it in. So again, yeah, I think the key here is tools over rules. So
tools over rules.
Tools over rules. No, there's no rules here. You got to figure out, is it actually big? Chances are, if it is just a side project, it's just you using it. Maybe it's running locally. You don't really care about load times all that much. You could just stick it in memory. But again, it's better to do stuff that is more real world too.
Yeah, definitely. Real world, no rules. Cool. Next question is from Tristan. And the question is, how much do I need to know before I start applying for dev jobs?
80.
80. You need to know 80.
80 web developments.
80 web developments. You got to know 50% CSS. You got to know 170% JavaScript. No, apply. Just apply. Because in my experience, a job interview is more useful than just a potential to get a job. A lot of people look at, all right, I'm taking a job interview simply to get a job. When I've never looked at it that way myself personally, especially when you get into dev jobs where you have to do things like, you know, coding challenges or any of this stuff, I personally look at dev interviews as practice. And I'm talking about practice here because this is like one of those things that you need practice of. How many things in your life have you ever been good at without practice? Like, I don't think very many of them. There's some things that I, you know, the very first time I try, oops, I did it and I'm good at it. But no, most of the time you need practice. So even if you're not good enough or you head into a job interview and you bomb it, that's not a problem. That's like experience. That's valuable experience. And if you're thinking, how much do I need to know? I don't know. I think you need to know probably the basics in terms of foundational HTML and CSS and just basic JavaScript. And it really depends on what kind of job you're applying for. Because when I applied and I got my first dev job, I didn't need to know any JavaScript. I didn't know any JavaScript when I got my first dev job. And, you know, things have changed a little bit now, but I think you can get a job doing anything as long as you just go for it. Apply, go to those job interviews and take that practice. That's my stance on this is don't worry about how much you need to know. Just go in there and be optimistic and try your best and learn something from it.
Yeah, I agree. I get this question all the time. And it's so hard to just quantify something like this. It's just like a sort of a feeling thing. How do I know what I need to know before? You definitely are going to be a little bit scared. So like Scott said, maybe try a few interviews and see sort of where you're at. Next question is from Fred Rivette. Do you folks have any opinions on skeleton loaders and how to best implement them? At my day job, we recently implemented skeleton loaders in a way that inherits the Parrot styles. Example, pop a skeleton line component inside of an H1 and it grows to fill the line height of the H1. Would love to know if there's any other best practices or ways that we can improve this. And then he links off to a Medium article on loading it in. So skeleton loader is where instead of just having like a spinner show up, you try to mimic the look of the content that's going to be populating on the page via boxes and just like lines of text that haven't loaded and grayed out images, things like that. So that when it does load, the whole page does not totally change, but the content sort of just fills itself on in. I really like this look for a lot of websites. I've only ever done it once on one website so far. And for that, what I did is I just created like a skeleton item. And we just show that skeleton item until the items actually get put in. So I don't really have a whole lot else to say here. What about you, Scott?
I think these things are neat. I think there was some sort of study that came out. I'm going to kind of butcher this because I'm going off the cuff here. But I think there was some study that came out that shows if you show a skeleton screen when the loading time is under a certain amount, that it actually the perceived loading time is slower than it would have been without the skeleton screen.
Really?
However, if you have content that does take a little bit longer to load, there's a threshold there of, hey, if it's at this point, then a skeleton screen perceived loading time is actually faster. But if it's actually a very fast already, then you don't want to use a skeleton screen because that will make people feel that your thing is slower. Go ahead and look that up. I'll look it up too and try to give it in the show notes or something. That said, I think skeleton screens are dope for a lot of reasons beyond just their name, which is also dope. I love that they're called skeleton screens. It invokes little skeleton images in my mind, but you know, I love it. I think this idea is really super cool. The websites that utilize it excellently do a really super duper good job. The ones that don't execute well on it, it can be a little off-putting. I love the things where the content sort of fades in from the skeleton screen rather than just like the skeleton screen's there and then it flashes in your content. I would love it if the skeleton screen were to like animate on and then fade into your actual content once it's loaded, almost sort of like the techniques that we do with image loading. I think that stuff is really sick where you have an image that's loaded in a crappier quality or an SVG, and then it fades into the full one once the full one's loaded. I think this kind of thing has a ton of potential. I think skeleton screens are going to become more prominent and more easy to do in terms of best practices. You know what? I think it's sort of the wild, wild west. There's sort of a lot of different solutions to this right now. I've seen some libraries that are just straight up divs with animated gradients and stuff that is pretty darn slick. I'm not quite sure if I was going to be doing this myself on Level Up Tutorials. I might reach to just do everything by hand and try to figure it out. Like they have like a skeleton line component, that kind of thing. I might just try to do that all myself to see if there's like some way that makes sense for me. Meanwhile, looking at other people's examples, this one I think is still open to like what the best practices actually are, because I think there are several different strategies for implementing this. But again, I like skeleton screens. I think it's a really cool strategy. Just be cognizant of when it's making your perceived loading time faster and when it's not. Next question is from Jin Wu. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing your first name incorrectly. I probably am. Do you think we still need CSS resets like normalize and sanitizer? Do I think we need them? Yeah, I think we do. I use Normalize on my site, and I probably always have. I think there's some newer ones. I just saw something about a newer one the other day. Quite sure what it's called. But to be honest, for those of you who don't know, the browser and browsers for a long time have had some baked-in default styles, whether that's margin, paddings, font sizes, all sorts of stuff. And for a long time, CSS reset was the thing to do, where you just dropped in a reset and it made everything blank, like just totally blank. Then people realized, well, the browser defaults are not awful. They're just all over the place. So what we then got was something called normalize, which takes them and makes them normalize so that all of the browsers are using sort of the same starting off points rather than just a flat blank point. Again, I use normalize. I've used it for a long time. I think I'll probably continue to use it for a long time just because it's easy to drop in your CSS. But what are your thoughts there?
It normalizes on version 8. So it's not like something that was made for IE6 and is just around. Right. They've dropped support for, I think, everything below IE11 now. And there's really not a whole lot in there. But there's things where sometimes I find myself being like, what is going on here? And then I go, oh, I didn't have normalize in here. And it's just little issues that it's so silly to think about your own, like, by default main display block. It does not display block in IE. If you just, like, look through the source code, you can read through it in probably a minute or two, and you'll just find these, like, little weird edge cases where they're from browser to browser, they're not totally the same. And those are the things that are going to cause you a whole lot of headaches down the road. So absolutely, you still need them. Just pop them in. You don't really have to worry about them past that.
Word. And next question is from Jamie Goebel. No, there's no I in the G-O.
Goebel.
Yeah. Okay, I'm so sorry, Jamie. I'm so sorry. Scott, can you tell me the story about how you landed an interview for a job in Japan? I am moving to Japan next year and wondering how that opportunity arose for you. This is actually an interesting... It's not necessarily an interesting story, but it's an interesting sort of anecdote to the importance of just talking to people. I am not an extrovert. It takes me a lot to just go to talk to people. One of my art classes that I was in college had a speaker come from the agency AKQA. They have locations all around the world. AKQA does insanely good work. I love AKQA's work. And I was just so impressed. And I knew they had an office in Tokyo. So they came in and talked. This was probably my senior year of college. And I wasn't an art major, but I went up to the speaker and I said, hey, I'm a developer. I wanted to be like a Flash developer at the time because I knew that they did a lot of Flash. And I just really wanted to work for AKQA, to be honest. And so I went up to them and I said, hey, you know, I'm looking for any sort of opportunity you got. You know, I'm taking Japanese language so I can, you know, head to your Tokyo office. I think they have more than one office in Japan. You know, I could go anywhere and work for you. And I would really love to work in Japan if that opportunity came about because I was taking the language. And this guy, who's honestly a very high up person at AKQA, had no reason to help me whatsoever. I'm just some random kid at a college class that just came up and asked a question. And he was like, okay, I don't have anything, but I know some agencies in Tokyo. And if you want me to, I can just shoot you some people's emails right now. And I said, sure. So I took the emails. And then because that guy's name had a lot of weight behind it, I would email them and I just said, hey, so-and-so told me that you might be looking for an intern here and I'd be happy to come work for you. And because of that, I got a job interview and they flew me out. They flew me out to Japan. They had a guide to take me around for a week, Tokyo, and did the interview and the place was amazing. So that's how I did it. But like the important thing isn't necessarily like, here's the spot that I went to get a job in Tokyo. The important thing is that talk to people, like let people know that you're looking for this, or you're trying to do this or whatever. Just ask people, because if I was just a hair slower on that, I would have never talked to that guy. And I, to be honest, it probably scared the crap out of me before I did it to just even go up to talk to him and say, hey, do you have anything? Because he's such a high level guy at the company. But I did it and I sucked it up and I got that valuable experience and I got a job interview and it was a really cool thing. So again, even if you're introverted or you have a hard time doing this, just really try to go up to talk to people, ask them, try to get that sort of stuff, because you never know what kind of opportunities will come about. We often just talk about making your intentions known. If you're a freelancer, just saying, hey, I'm looking for clients, blah, blah, blah. It can really, really make a difference. And if you're looking to make a difference in the sort of performance, the error tracking, the bugs, all that sort of stuff on your website, the general health of how your application is functioning, you're going to want to check out one of our sponsors. Now, one of our sponsors today is Sentry at Sentry.io. They've been a sponsor of Syntax for a little bit. And let me tell you a little bit about Sentry. Now, Sentry is the bug error tracking service. It works with any of the tools, frameworks, anything that you've ever wanted to use. And it's used by so many companies that you know and love. I mean, it's used by Airbnb, Dropbox, PayPal, Uber, Microsoft, Reddit, Adroll, Prezi, DoorDash. If you were to walk around San Francisco and look at all of the different billboards, you could say, hey, they use Sentry, and hey, they use Sentry. It seems like everybody is using Sentry to track their bugs, and for good reason, because their system makes it really easy to find about errors and exceptions and allows you to quickly integrate with any of the technologies and tools you know and love, all of the coding platforms, native stuff, Python stuff, PHP stuff, .NET stuff, Java stuff, JavaScript stuff, anything. And then it works with all of the platforms you know and love, like Slack, GitHub, GitLab, Heroku, Twilio, just so many. Asana.
Asana. You got it right.
Yeah. Asana. Bitbucket, any of this stuff. So check it out. Head over to Sentry at sentry.io. Track your errors, bugs, and exceptions like a pro. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and get 2 months for free. You're going to love that. So check it out at sentry.io.
Next question we have here is from The Dan. Love y'all's podcast. Actually gave me motivation again to get after it after losing my first dev job. Awesome. I've been listening to it while delivering pizzas. Wow. Bring in the treats just like us. That's good. thanks so much. I look forward to your future tasty treats. My question, you guys talk a lot about React and or Vue, but only really mention Angular when discussing the big three major players in the JMS framework and never really in depth. Do you have any opinion on Angular? I'm not talking about AngularJS, which is what people refer to as 1.0. Good or bad? Or is that you're more comfortable have used the other two? And then there's some other stuff about I'm looking into all the three. So people ask me this all the time. It's probably six times a day I get an Instagram DM about it. Like, what are your thoughts on which one do you use? React. Why? And then I'm going to go, I don't know. It's really just like we've talked about at some point. I was on Angular 1.0. They announced Angular 2, but there's this big gap. So I picked up React and I really enjoy it. And I've been on that ever since. So that's not to say that Angular or Vue is any better or any worse. It's really just all that we do. And that's why we talk about it, because that's what we use. And that's pretty much it. So I wouldn't think that Angular is bad or something like that. It's just not something that we use.
Yeah. And I think part of it, you know, the whole mess of Angular, AngularJS, the distinction where anytime you say one or the other, people get sort of riled up about you're saying the wrong one incorrectly, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that whole thing just confuses people. And I honestly think that that confusion around version 2 and version 1 and whatever, I think that just really hurt Angular as a platform. Yeah. And that's personally why I sort of moved away from it, because it just didn't seem like it had an identity that was like as solid. Now fast forward to 2019, and the people who stuck around Angular 2, and now it's at version 8 or 9 or whatever.
15, yeah.
Yeah. I think everyone who stuck around really likes it. They like it for what it is. That said, I can't get into it now. I'm loving React, and now with the release of React Hooks and Suspense, I'm loving working in React. And to be honest, I really love working in Vue. And I just don't know if I have the capacity to add in another one.
There's no more love to give with Scott.
There's no more love to give. And even if I did, I think I would go for something that takes a much different approach, like Svelte or something.
Yeah.
Which Svelte version 3 is really cool. So I'm sorry, Angular fans. It's not that I don't like Angular. It's just that I got no room. The fan's full. Next up, we have a question from Evaldus, and I'm getting all the hard names this time. I'm getting all Evaldus. Of them.
I think that's right.
Evaldus, yes. Hi. Could you talk about naming and structuring files/folders in your applications? At the moment, I'm building a website with Gatsby. I'm having quite a lot of smaller components that I'm reusing throughout the website. I'm slowly drowning in folders and files within my app to the point where nothing makes any sense in my website structure. How do you name components, folders? Do you follow some sort of path? How do you structure files in web apps? This is a question that comes up all the time, specifically because the React team, for better or for worse, I think it's probably for better, to be honest, does not have like strict, hey, here's how you do it in terms of project structure, where other platforms like Rails have been much more like, this is the way.
Yeah.
So how do you go about this? I personally have developed my own file system that I absolutely love working in. And to be honest, it's really not that complex, but as long as you have a system that works for you, having a system is a big deal. Now, I should also say, when you're making your system, things will change, and you should be willing to constantly adjust and adapt your system. It's not really that hard to refactor file names, folder names, project structures. I do it all the time, and I have a big application. So yeah. That said, so here's what I do. I do feature folders, okay? We have the, in terms of components, we have our standard components for things that are only used once based on features. For instance, all of the playlists or the series-based stuff are in one folder. All of the My Account, My Portfolio, or My Profile stuff is in another folder. The checkout stuff is in another folder. The admin stuff, the search features, all this stuff, they're in their own feature folders. Inside of those feature folders are all of my GraphQL queries and related components. Next, I have folders for reusable stuff. For instance, if I'm using styled components, which I am, I have an elements folder, which is all my reusable components. The stuff I could think of as being like my own personal HTML elements, right? The stuff that's reused all the time, not the stuff that's one-off. So anything that's reused, it goes in the elements folder. I also have a utilities folder. And now utilities is often used for things like my colors, my breakpoints, my icons, my loader, that sort of stuff. I also have a hooks folder, which is a new one for me, where I include all of my hooks. And I have a global state folder, which includes all of my context and state stuff. But other than that, it's feature folders. One of the things I do to make things nice and organized is because I don't have a ton of stuff in any of these folders, in particular with the elements, utilities, those things, what I do is I create an index for the folder. The index is an index.js inside of the folder that then imports and exports everything from the index. That way, I have all of my elements essentially collected, and instead of having to import a layout from UI elements layouts, I can then import both my layout as well as my typography from imports UI elements. So creating an index at the root of your folder for some of these things is a really good idea, especially the stuff that's highly reused, where in other situations, it's maybe less of a good idea for the things that are one-off used or larger components or things like that. So I do straight up feature folders, and then I do specific folders like what I just mentioned.
Yeah, I'm pretty much very, very similar with the exception of not using index.js. I just name it whatever I want to name the component. In that, I'll usually, in that folder, I'll also include my styles and the tests for that specific component. But for different apps, I have different approaches. And I think the main importance is just keep it somewhat simple at first. And then as you find yourself needing to go more complex, then absolutely go more complex. I've certainly been in very simple applications where people have 4,000 folders and it's impossible to move around it and to get familiar with the application. Just like Scott says, refactor as you need it into a more complex folder structure.
Word. So complex folder structures, you don't want to have to deal with complex data structures. I don't know if that's a good transition, but one of our sponsors here at Syntax has been a longtime sponsor, which is Sanity. It makes your working with your backend data and having your data as a service just totally effortless. And they have some sweet new features that Wes is going to talk about.
Yeah, so Sanity.io is a headless CMS. So it's sort of a bring your own front end. So think about something like Next or Nux or Gatsby, and you want to pipe in some data to the back end. Sign up for Sanity and that will be your back end. One kind of cool thing about Sanity is that you can actually bring your own React components to their back end. So that's kind of like they host it for you, but you still have control over what the UI looks like when you're uploading and modifying your data. They've just rolled out this new thing called Sanity Create, which is really cool. Sort of the tagline here is have a Sanity powered site up and running in minutes. So if you want to try out Sanity, you have to sort of do two things. You have to pick a platform because you need like something like Gatsby or Next or Nuxt. And then you need like somewhere to host it and something like Netlify. So what they've done is they've created sort of like one click installs for something like this, and you can get a portfolio running with Gatsby or a tech event running with Next or a landing page with Nuxt. You can get all of these different examples up and running really quickly, and then you have all of the pieces in place between hooking up your Git, hooking up your Netlify, having the actual code that needs to be run and the back end on Sanity. So that's just a great way to sort of see the power. And if you're just like wondering, like, I've never built a Jamstack website, try this out. Go to sanity.io/create and try it out. I think you're going to be pretty, pretty impressed. Thanks so much to Sanity for sponsoring.
Pretty impressed.
Pretty, pretty, pretty impressed.
Yep. Got a little Larry David. Larry David going on.
Two more questions here. This one's from Brent K. That was a really easy one for me. Hi, Wes and Scott. Hi.
I got all the hard ones.
Yeah, you do. I have a question about backend techs, specifically Node. Do you think Node is almost too powerful to handle some of the simpler tasks? A site that just needs a contact form, for instance, Or am I missing some very simple configuration? It seems like other languages, such as PHP, might be better suited for the simple task, and Node is really meant for larger scale application. Also, I am starting to think, because as I have looked into hosting for Node.js applications, some hosting companies don't host Node.js on their basic plans. HostGator is another. And so I'm about halfway through this question. Hang on. And so you would need to upgrade to a dedicated server just to host a Node Express server-side code that simply sends a post request to an email. I guess my question really boils down to, as a freelancer, I understand that I need to have my hands in a lot of different tech stacks, but should I really just dive into PHP or maybe something else to handle simpler features like this? Thanks, guys. Keep doing what you're doing because it's fantastic. Woo! All right. Boop, boop. A lot here. Is Node meant for much more complex things versus something like PHP? No, I don't think so. They can be all made for small things or much larger things. I think the sort of the frustration that's coming along here is sort of two part. First, PHP is just really easy. You can just write a file and hit it and handle all the logic in one file. With Node, you need to have you need a server to be up and running. You need to start that server and listen on ports. Then you need some sort of routing. And all of that stuff, starting the server, routing, all of that stuff sort of just comes for free with PHP, which is why it's so easy to sort of get up and running. So there is that sort of and I think that's sort of where serverless functions are going to really shine, where you can just write a single JS file and deploy that as a serverless function. And the serverless function will take care of routing and giving you that request payload. And then you can simply just do what you need to do, send an email, log the data, put it in a database, and then send a response back to that specific user. So I think that that's one spot there. I think also part of the frustration is not having a good approach to hosting Node applications, because you think okay, I want to host this thing. I can't just throw a folder up to my GoDaddy and it works. So obviously there's things now.sh or I know Netlify is getting into serverless functions. There's lots of people trying to make that area easier right now. And so you're not alone in thinking that this is too hard. It is absolutely too hard. But what I do is I have a DigitalOcean server, and then I use something called PM2. And what this will do is allow you to run multiple processes on your actual server at once. And then you can run a very simple, and this is probably where it's very simple. I'm doing air quotes here. You also have to run what's called an Nginx config on there that will proxy it. So you can do subdomains or /app1 and /app2. And for that way, you can get away with $5 DigitalOcean all day long. And I think that's probably even cheaper than doing a HostGator or something like that. So it definitely does require a little bit more setup. There's people trying to solve that right now and getting it easier. We used to have this thing called Nojitsu, which was amazing. Yeah. And Nojitsu was really, really good. And they got bought by GoDaddy and they did nothing with it, which I was very frustrated to see because I absolutely loved Nojitsu. It's sort of what Now is trying. I keep thinking Next. It's sort of what Now is trying to do right now, which is pretty cool. So I say hold tight. Definitely worth still learning Node, given those caveats of there is a little bit more overhead than just a PHP script. But also then if it's just a simple contact form and you feel like doing it in PHP, absolutely nothing wrong with that. Aside from the fact that you'll probably get spammed to hell on almost anything that doesn't have a CAPTCHA or something installed on it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think this is a good opportunity if you wanted to do Node for this. This is the perfect use case for a serverless function, just because it's so lightweight and easy to get going. I recently used the functions on Netlify and really liked it. So if you're on Netlify, that's an option. If you're not, then, serverless functions elsewhere is something to look into. Again, I think you really covered all of the bases there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, I think you nailed it. Next question is from San Malik. I think I got it.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about Svelte? Before everything goes WASM, will Svelte be the future of programming? So, okay, for those of you who don't know about Svelte, let me tell you a little bit about Svelte.
I've never used Svelte myself before. It's called a cybernetically enhanced web app. I'm very curious.
Which is funny because people were ripping on that. I think that's funny. It's cybernetically enhanced, or it looks like it's from Terminator. It's funny.
I don't understand it.
Yeah, I think it's from Terminator. If it's not, then shout me out about it. But so what is Svelte? Well, Svelte is it's not necessarily it's newish JavaScript framework. It came out with version 3 last month by the time you're listening to this. And what's interesting or different about Svelte? Well, Svelte disappears. They used to call it the magically disappearing framework, because what happens is you build your application in Svelte, and then you don't actually ship a library with your application. You just ship code. So it compiles down to nothing, essentially. It compiles down to JavaScript. So that's the reason why you would want to learn Svelte, because, hey, you don't have to ship React. You don't have to ship Vue or whatever. And one of the cool things that happened recently in Svelte when they went to version 3 is that they really changed a lot about how you're working with data, the sort of just the general data binding aspects of things. And to be honest, remember the good old days of Angular 1 where you just threw everything on scope and it all felt really fun and interesting when you were first learning it?
Yeah.
You know, to be honest, I think Svelte like can really, with the new way it's doing things, can really invoke some of those feelings, because the modern way of, or the version 3 way of writing Svelte is pretty darn slick. And to be honest, I think it's really cool the way they handle state. Basically, if you have a count variable, you could define it in your script tag, sort of like you do in Vue. You'd say let count equal to 0. You'd have a function called handle click that just does count plus equals to 1. And then guess what? In your HTML or your Svelte templating language code, you could just output count. And then when you click on the thing, you run the handle click, and you don't have to reference, you don't have to bind, you don't have to create state. You just got a variable, and that variable is scoped to that component. It's pretty cool. And it's a modern JavaScript framework. And let me tell you, Svelte version 3 is sort of blowing up, because I think people really, really like it. It's truly reactive, as they say, no virtual DOM, write less code. Now, the part of this question that I don't necessarily get is the part that's talking about WASM. Before everything goes WASM, will Svelte be the future? I don't think WASM fits in here at all. I don't think it really, really matters or has anything to do with this. Svelte is just another approach for a JavaScript front-end framework. And I think Svelte is taking a different enough approach that it's definitely worth your time. Because some of these things are all just maybe like a different syntax to do the same thing. I honestly think Svelte has enough original ideas that it feels like a very different thing. At the same time, feels very accessible and has a lot of upsides to it. So I might be doing a Svelte tutorial course. I'm still looking into doing that. It was actually when I had previously started to record at some point for Svelte version 2. Before I found out about the timeline for version 3. So now that version 3 is out here, if you are interested in that, let me know. It could be something we could put together. Again, it looks really super cool. I think easy is the right word. Easy, effortless. The bundle that you're going to ship is going to be smaller. I think it's really cool.
That's really cool. I want to check out Svelte at some point. I've been hearing a lot about it. The code examples look kind of Vue-y.
Yeah, it's like Vue-y. It's like Angular 1-y. It's kind of effortless looking. It looks nice.
Neat. Neat. Next question we have is from Noel Garcia. What smartphones and laptops do you use for work? Specific model and why? So this is going to be a bit boring for me. I have the iPhone XS, XS Max Plus Touring Edition, Eddie Bauer interior.
I was like, at what point are these? Because I don't know iPhone stuff. So I was like, okay. And then when you got to the Touring Edition, I was like, oh, okay, he's joking. But like, I wasn't sure how many of those were actually joking.
Yeah, no, I like it. It's as big as a phone you can get. Takes awesome photos, and it works well. And then I have, I don't know what kind of laptop I have. I have the MacBook that will be crippled if you get a crumb in it. I don't know. I bought it like a year and a half ago, and I maxed it out. It's super fast, super stable. I really like it, except for the actual hardware itself. But I spend probably 98% of my days having it just docked. As well, I've never been one to like have a desktop and then have like a laptop and then try to sync stuff between those. I just like having absolutely everything on one computer, huge hard drive, having everything on there. And it's just the perfect setup for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to do when I had my Hackintosh, the two system thing. And that was such a nightmare.
Yeah,
it was such a nightmare. And so what I decided to do was not use my desktop anymore. And instead of getting an underpowered laptop, get an overpowered-ish laptop. I have a 15-inch MacBook Pro that has 32 gigs of RAM and 2.9 gigahertz i9 processor.
That's it?
Yeah.
I have 3.1 i7.
Yeah, so. Well, mine's an i9. bro.
Well, you got more eyes, but I got more gigs hertz.
How many cores do you got? How many cores?
Intel Core i7. How many cores does it Intel? Isn't that four?
Well, I don't know how many yours has, but mine has six. If mine has six i9 2.9 gigahertz cores and yours has four 3.1, whatever, then I win. So
let's see here. How many cores does an i7 have?
If you go to About This Mac, it'll tell you.
They have four. Oh, four. That's it.
That's it.
Yeah. Boom. It's a 15-inch 2017. So yeah, it's almost 2 years old and it's still chugging along. I only have 16 gigs of RAM, like a sucker.
Yeah, like a sucker. So mine is a 2018, but only because Apple Apple, for those of you who did not hear that story, Apple broke my computer and then gave me a nice discount on the super high powered one. So I have a much better computer than I originally bought. And I only just pay like $300 for it because they broke my other one and then lied about it. So that's my computer. And my phone is a Pixel 2 XL. I will be getting the Pixel 4 whenever it comes out, even though they haven't said anything about it. So I don't know anything about it, but I'm going to get it anyways because I love my Pixel 2. It's been a great phone. Before then, I always had the Google Nexus phones, but the Pixel 2 XL for me has just been amazing. Performance-wise, battery-wise, camera is incredible. My wife has the Pixel 3 XL, and it's been amazing for her. So nothing but good experiences, to be honest. And I like running the betas. I like getting all that software stuff. So I like using the Pixel phone, and I'm a big, big, big fan here. So that's specific models, laptops for why. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I would love it if there was a future where I could just like plug my phone into a monitor and do all my coding on my Pixel and like have it be all VS Code and Linux and stuff. Maybe that's a future some point. Who knows? I actually did see recently, this is sort of unrelated, but I think it's called Bliss OS. Bliss OS is looks like it's a distro. Is that what you say? An open source distro of Android that runs on every device, including MacBooks and Surface Books and stuff like that. So I have an old 13-inch MacBook that's just sitting in my closet. I'm going to install Android on my MacBook as its main OS, and I'm going to try it. I know this Bliss OS is very fresh and probably kind of buggy, but I would really love to see what that's like running Android. And then basically it's a Linux system. You could install any of your Linux stuff on it. I wouldn't mind trying that out. It's just like a fun little thing here. So check it out. I think it's at blissroms.com if you want to see more
about
that.
They're hosted on SourceForge. Remember stuff used to be on SourceForge?
Yeah.
Then they had like the banners that would be like download here, like the ads that looked like download buttons.
Yeah, where do you click?
They really shot themselves in the foot, hey? I hate it. Yeah,
for real. That's like a huge, huge industry. And they're just like, you know what? We're good with this crappy system here. Then
screwing people. And I remember they always had like the like diamond plate background design. I wonder if there's an image of the old SourceForge. Do you remember like the design of the old SourceForge?
I'm sure I do, but I don't. It's not coming to me right now off the top of my head, but I've been on SourceForge enough that.
Yeah. If you saw, I can't find a screenshot of it. But those were the days.
Those were the days.
All right. Last question from Aaron. A.A. Aaron. Should I apply for other jobs even if my contract might get renewed? Should I feel loyal to a company? Yeah. If your contract might get renewed, it might not. So absolutely apply. I think Scott talked about this on a previous episode. You basically said, like, go for it. You can always say no to the job, but you might stumble into something really nice, something really well paying, something that you really enjoy the work at. So go ahead. It's nothing but practice at the worst.
Yeah. And we talked about it. The reason why I added this question at the end here is because we talked about it early in this episode, but we talked about it before. A lot of times people put too much weight into job interviews. Like, this job interview has a lot of weight. It's a thing. No, it does not. It's you go apply for jobs. You're not hurting anyone's feelings. You don't have to accept a job. If you don't want your current employer to know that you're applying for jobs, then don't put your current employer down as a reference. And then if they ask why your current employer is not a reference, we'll say, hey, my contract might get renewed there. I didn't want to make them angry to let them know that I was interviewing around or something. But hey, if you're really interested in hiring me for this, then please go ahead and talk to them. Because that's that's definitely just something you want to do. You want to practice, you want to get in, you interview. But again, the interview is not a job offer that you are accepting. You get an interview, go take it, do well. I can't emphasize that enough. But yeah, I think that wraps up this potluck. We got a pack it up. And I think there's a storm. No, there's not a storm coming. It's a nice and sunny day here for this potluck.
We are going to do sick picks now. I don't necessarily have another sick pick just because we've been batch recording these. But I needed to like work on a rotate a photo and touch it up really quickly today. And I ended up just paying someone to do it for me because I haven't had Photoshop on my computer for a couple of years now, and Sketch and Figma, these things aren't really meant for raster-based editing. And a bunch of people said, use Affinity. Have you ever checked this out, Scott?
Affinity?
Affinity Photo. There's Affinity Designer.
Yeah. I have a tutorial course on Affinity Photo.
Do you really? Yeah. Is it's good?
It's good. It's basically like Photoshop. The thing that makes me upset about Affinity, and I like Affinity, the thing that makes me upset about it is things like some shortcuts, keyboard shortcuts and menus and stuff are like one-to-one the same as Photoshop, and others are just different enough where it's going to make you really mad. How do I find this thing? The application's great, no, it's very powerful. It can do anything Photoshop can do. I have it installed just because I bought it a long time ago, but yeah, no, it's pretty cool. It's very comparable. You know, there's like some open source Photoshop alternatives like GIMP and stuff.
Yeah.
Is that an Illustrator one? Either way.
GIMP's a Photoshop alternative, yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's way better than GIMP. So yeah, it's much more of a Photoshop comparative.
I need to try this out. I also am so jealous of everybody who edits stuff on the iPad. Like anytime you buy a texture pack, they're always just for iPad like apps. And instead of like being for desktop apps anymore. And I miss being able to do that sort of raster stuff or Photoshop someone's face on something or whatever. So this is not really a sick pick because I haven't tried it yet, but I'm going to test it out. And I thought I'd just let other people know that are looking for something similar as well.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. I'll go with you and keep the same sort of theme going. An app that is taking the place of popular, highly frequently used in production apps like Photoshop, whatever, is for me, a big one has been DaVinci Resolve. And this might have even been a sick pick of mine before, but let me tell you, I use DaVinci Resolve for video editing. And for those of you who do any sort of actual professional level video editing, you've probably used Premiere and Final Cut. You probably know that Final Cut X, although it's really cool, is very weird in some ways. DaVinci Resolve is a lot more like Adobe Premiere, but let me tell you, it's free and it works on any OS. So you can use it on Linux or Mac or Windows, and it's free. It is as good as any of these other ones. I've been using it professionally. The color grading stuff is sick. The audio tools are sick. Literally everything about this application is sick. So DaVinci Resolve is my sick pick. It's a really cool app. And it looks like they just came out with version 16. I'm rocking 15 right now, so I'm going to need to upgrade to 16 and see what's new. It looks like they give you 8K editing in version 16.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm into it.
All right, shameless plugs today. I'm going to plug all of my courses at westboss.com/courses. Use code Syntax to grab anything. If you want to learn React, ES6, ES7, ES9, any of the ESs, CSS, there's a whole bunch of free ones up there as well. Check it out, westboss.com/courses.
Nice. I'm going to shamelessly plug all of my courses as well. And I have a new course out every single month on leveluptutorials.com. And if you sign up to become a pro, you get access to everything on the site. So that is like hugely important because there's a new course every single week. And if you sign up for the year, that means you get all of the, I think there's like 27 pro courses right now, and you'll get 12 additional pro courses over the course of the year. It's a lot of courses. The latest one is on React animations. So check it out at leveluptutorials.com/pro.
All right. I think that's it for today. Thanks for tuning in, and we will catch you next week.
We will catch you next week. And we're recording this episode in the future, or in the past, I guess, at this point. And it's really bizarre to say this before I say peace. It's very bizarre. By the time you are listening to this episode, I'm going to have a baby.
Yeah.
My daughter is going to be here by now, by the time you're listening to this. So this is very wild for me.
Yeah, that is really weird to think about the future, but it's now.
It is really weird, especially when it involves the new human being that you're taking care of. So welcome to this world, Brooklyn Talinsky. And this is really sick. So yeah. Okay. But we will catch you in the next one. That's all we got for now. Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.